We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 50. I'm Jessica Uquinto and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking about Native youth and land-based education. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dene Taa, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today we have Dr. Lindsay Schneider on the show. Lindsay Schneider is a Turtle Mountain Chippewa descendant scholar who grew up in the Pacific Northwest, surrounded by rivers, big trees, and salmon. Her published work deals with salmon restoration in the Pacific Northwest, treaty fishing rights, and American Indian STEM education. She is currently an assistant professor of Native American Studies in the Department of Ethnic Studies at Colorado State University, where she teaches courses in environmental justice and Indigenous studies. So welcome to the show, Dr. Schneider.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, okay, so how did you get interested in this type of work and what got you into this field?
Yeah, so it's kind of been a lifelong journey for me. So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I am, as I mentioned in my bio, Turtle Mountain Chippewa descendant. My grandma was a really important person to me and really fostered a sense of pride in who I was and that connection to our tribe. But I grew up in Oregon City, end of the Oregon Trail. Obviously, a lot of historical connections to westward expansion and, the Homestead Act and all that stuff. So there was a lot of curriculum around that sort of thing when I was a kid. So definitely some sort of moments of cognitive dissonance of like, wait, I'm hearing one thing, from my teachers about how like Indians don't exist anymore. And, this is all a thing of the past. And, and they all lived in teepees. And that's sort of the end of the story, and then my grandma would take me to a powwow and I'd be like, this, something's not adding up here. So that, I think really that kind of disconnect is what got me really interested in researching the history of our tribe and Native people in general. And then I think, how I ended up in terms of getting a PhD and ending up as a professor, that really boiled down to having really good mentorship. There's a lot of Native women, who just were there to kind of push me along the right path, and whether that was into grad school or into writing. And so I think, in terms of ending up specifically in this career, that was really a matter of other folks looking out for me.
Yeah. Can you give an example of some of the mentorship that you got that you found really helpful?
Yeah. I mean, part of it was just, when I was in undergrad, I saw that there was a class listed on the course schedule called Native Women Writers. And everyone I talked to was just like, are there enough of them how can you even have a whole class on that? I of course was like, oh my gosh, like I have to take this, and for many reasons, of course, that the person teaching it was not tenure track faculty, right? She was like a visiting professor. It was Janice Gould, who's actually a fairly well-known Native woman writer herself. And that class just really changed my life. I mean, part of it was just knowing that like Native people can get PhDs and be professors. Like she was the first Native faculty I'd ever had or even heard of. So even just that level of like basic representation, like to see somebody who could talk about the same kinds of things that you could relate to in that kind of position, that was huge. But then, I mean, she also just was like an amazing mentor in the sense of being so encouraging and, very, very supportive and making the time to really seek out and be there for Native students, which I think is something I've always tried to emulate now as a professor myself, that like, those are the ones, that I'm here for and really trying to look out for.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get into like more of your specific area of focus once you're an undergrad? Obviously, there's a million mm-hmm. things that you could have focused on. How did you get from there, to your PhD?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I tried focusing on a million different things. One of the benefits of a liberal arts college, you get to do that. So I didn't actually discover ethnic studies until I think my junior year. And then I, you know, just got started taking those classes because a friend had recommended them. And, you know, that, of course, I had one of those like transformative, like, oh my gosh, this is blowing my mind kind of moments that, you know, I know this stuff's true because it's my life, but like, oh my God, there's a whole field of research on it. So then after, you know, and I kind of found it late. And so then after I graduated, I was thinking like, okay, I think maybe grad school, but I don't really know. So I kind of took some time, you know, worked at Starbucks for a while, did the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, just kind of bouncing around. And actually then Andrea Smith, the person who would eventually become my dissertation advisor, I just happened to meet her at a community event where she was speaking and asked a question and chatted with her a bit afterwards. And she was like, you need to go to, you know, you need to go to UCR and get a degree in ethnic studies. I just was, you know, pretty lost at that point in my life. So I was kind of like, okay, I'll do that. So that's how I ended up in my program. And then in terms of sort of the specific research that I'm doing now, I actually really wanted to start out looking at Indigenous food justice issues and sort of broadly, you know, comparing kind of some of the struggles that my own people have faced in terms of Great Lakes treaty rights and the histories there, you know, maybe comparing that with what's gone on in the Pacific Northwest and some other food justice issues. And then once I started really diving into the research, I realized that, you know, having grown up in the Pacific Northwest, you know, even though our tribal connections are in North Dakota, you know, that those were the fishing struggles that I'd grown up hearing about, that I knew the most about, that I, you know, just, I had the kind of the background knowledge and the passion for. I grew up in a family where everyone fishes, we all eat salmon, it's a huge thing, you know, and grew up with a very deep sense of, you know, how important those issues were, that, you know, whatever fishing we're doing here, it is as guests in these territories. And so having kind of realized that and kind of trying to figure out a way to come to grips with the fact that, you know, I am Indigenous, but I'm not enrolled, you know, and I'm also like, I grew up on somebody else's homeland. And so what does it mean to be an uninvited guest here, you know, taking up space, using these resources? So really that research on the Columbia River Basin was kind of a way to try to figure out what does it mean to be accountable to the land and the water that raised me and the people who have those Indigenous ties to those spaces.
Yeah. And just curious, when you started working with those communities, what was their reaction to that, you know, struggle that you're having?
Yeah, I was really varied, you know, and that's one of the things I think people often assume there's like an Indigenous perspective, right? And of course, like all tribal communities are different, all, you know, Native people are different. So I was able to intern at the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission back when I was an undergrad. And that was really great. Folks were really encouraging and, you know, and it was such a good experience and really cool to see the level at which tribes were engaging the federal government and advocating for policy change. And then after that, a lot of my sort of research connections ended up kind of organically evolving out of the work that I was doing at the University of Idaho. So after I finished my coursework for my PhD, I moved back up to the Northwest and got a job in the Native American Student Center at the University of Idaho. So mostly doing kind of during the school year support for students, just like across the board troubleshooting for whatever sorts of problems they were having, you know, barriers that were coming up to them finishing their degrees, cultural programming and that sort of thing. And then doing some work during the summer to put on a STEM camp for high school needs. Youth who were members of some of the local tribes. And so really just getting to work with students who were getting their degrees because they wanted to be fisheries managers or wildlife scientists, you know, and go back and work for their tribe's natural resource management departments. That it was really, I mean, an incredible honor, of course, to be able to do that work, but also really exciting in the sense that it, you know, it just, I felt like I really got to be kind of at the ground level of what was happening in terms of, you know, different programs tribes were trying to implement or changes they were trying to make or what sort of policy conversations they wanted to be having.
So can you tell us a little bit more about how all of that experience tied into your future work?
Yeah. So one of the things I think that was really made clear to me or became apparent when I was doing that work is that, you know, there's a lot of Native activists having conversations about land back and repatriation and different ways that we can promote and support Indigenous resilience and sort of the resurgence of Indigenous knowledge about the environment and Indigenous sciences and Indigenous forms of land management practices and all those sorts of things, which I think is so, you know, all that stuff is so great and so important. And I realized, you know, as I was doing that work, that if we don't prepare the youth to take up, you know, to kind of take up the torch for this work, there won't be anybody who's able to do it, you know? So it really just drove home how important it is that, you know, when we're having these conversations about, you know, if we want to fundamentally change the sort of the agenda for what it looks like for tribes to be able to engage in resource management and land management policy decisions, that we need to have youth at the table. You know, they need to be part of those conversations. We need to make sure that we're equipping them with the skills so that they, you know, can be like fully involved in that kind of work. And that was kind of what pushed me in the direction of, you know, I'm still very much interested in studying kind of the history and the science of what tribes are doing, especially in terms of fisheries. But I feel like in tandem with that, it's so important to make sure that we're bringing the youth in as we do that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think those are two topics that I want to obviously go way more in depth on. But before we do that, let's continue on your journey. So from there, then what was next?
Yeah. So once I finished my PhD, looking for academic positions and ended up landing at Colorado State, which was definitely an adjustment in terms of just, you know, at the University of Idaho, you've got, I think, 5 reservations, you know, within a couple hours of driving distance, you know, and the university has a pretty long history of working really closely with tribal communities. You know, no institution is perfect, but I think there were some really, really strong relationships there that already existed. So then I got to CSU, you know, and kind of realized like, oh, the sort of general population in Colorado, the narrative is that Native people were removed. And so they're not here anymore, you know, and I know that's not true because, you know, here I am and I'm connecting with Native folks at the university and in the community. So it just was really surprised to find this kind of disconnect between sort of what, you know, a lot of my students and the intro level classes who, you know, are non-Native are coming in like, yeah, gosh, it's really sad, you know, that their land was taken away, but, you know, they're not here anymore. So what can you do about it? And the more conversations I had with Native folks in the community in Fort Collins, the more I was, you know, just realized that story, like, that's not just my college students that are coming in from across the state with that perception. That's in the local school district, you know, in the curriculum that gets taught there, you know, that same kind of perception, you know, and I think often not even in a malicious way. It's just, you know, it's that very kind of like, you know, all this, well, this is sad, but it's ancient history, you know, and I'm hearing from friends whose kids are in classrooms, hearing that from their teachers. And it was really disheartening to find out that, you know, what happened to me decades ago is still happening to these kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, different place, but kind of similar histories in terms of like, you know, it's Fort Collins. There's a reason, you know, particular history associated with that name, you know, so that's what, you know, where I kind of got involved with with doing the community work that I'm doing now in Colorado.
Yeah, that's so fascinating because, okay, so obviously we both live in Colorado, but two very different parts of the state. So like when I first moved to Colorado, I lived up in Meeker, which obviously, I mean, it was the location of what is most commonly known as the Meeker Massacre, and which the tribes don't like. So I'm going to call it the Meeker Incident. But I mean, there is a very strong particular history there and people know, you know, what happened and where the tribe is. And, you know, like, yeah, it's a particular situation in that town for sure. And then, you know, living now in Cortez in the Four Corners, we're literally between two tribes, but, you know, we live in Colorado, but like, you know, whenever you say that to somebody and they're like, oh, Denver. It's like, no, that's we're closer to three other state capitals than our own. It's a very different world right. down here. So I had no idea that that was the perception on the Front Range in my own state. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think there's just an awareness that comes with proximity to what feels like native space. And I think that's kind of a big piece of it now, is that like non-native folks tend to perceive native space as reservations, right? Instead mm-hmm. of recognizing mm-hmm. that, like, you know, just because folks got removed doesn't mean those connections were permanently severed.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And on that note, I think we are at our first break point, but definitely want to touch more on that topic, as well as, you know, fishing and treaty rights and, you know, education when we come back in the next segments. So we'll be right back.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, HEVO. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right, we are back. And we were just talking about when you first got to CESU. What has your focus been while you've been at CESU? What are you excited about right now?
Yeah, so the thing I'm most excited about is a summer camp that I've developed in collaboration with another faculty member and a bunch of folks from the community here in Fort Collins. So we have been working with the Fort Collins Museum of Discovery. They've just been really phenomenal community partners. So I kind of got pulled into a conversation where they were realizing they wanted to do kind of more work to better outreach with the Native community, at the same time that the school district was realizing, you know, we could maybe be doing a better job of supporting Native students. We're not really sure what that looks like. So again, you know, nothing happens without mentorship. I had some really good support from another faculty member in my department, kind of coached me through the process. But we set up a listening session for the Native community to just get a chance to talk about what was going on, what the issues they were seeing, you know, for their students in the school district. It was really amazing to see how many of these families were dealing with the same stuff and they thought they were the only one, right? Because there actually are quite a few Native families in Fort Collins, but we're spread out across the district. And so, you know, most of these kids are the only Native student, you know, in their class, if not at their school. And so it was really amazing just, I think, for folks to be able to see like, oh, okay, yeah, like everybody's dealing with the same thing. You know, we do need to be talking about it. Something needs to be done. So one of kind of our first steps in terms of addressing that was to put on a summer camp for K-12 Native youth, where we're basically just trying to give the students a chance to connect with each other. So they're like in a space with other Native kids and, you know, getting to see that they're not the only ones in the district and build some social connections and friendships. And then also, you know, get them outside and get them on the land. So all of the activities we did, we ran a week, it was a week long program where each day we had a different community elder expert come in to talk about something. And then the kids had some kind of activity that they went that either got them outside, connecting to, you know, whatever nature space is nearby, whether that's a park or their backyard, or got them connected to their family. So one of the activities was like to interview a family member about some of their tribal beliefs and connections and things like that. So, you know, obviously there were some changes we had to make because of the pandemic. We can talk more about that. But I think that's the thing I'm most excited about right now.
Okay. Was this year, last year, 2020, was that the first time that you had done it, or had you already been doing it and then had to adjust?
Yeah. For the pandemic? Yeah. No, it was the first time. So it was a pilot program that we got some funding to try. And we were in the midst of planning it when the pandemic sort of brought everything to a screeching halt.
Yeah.
And I really distinctly remember a moment when the other faculty member I was working with was like, well, we can be one more program that cancels, or we can be the program that didn't. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And I was just like, all right, we're going to figure out a way to do this. We're not going to be, you know, one more program that says, oh, you're on your own because it's a pandemic. So we ended up, I had a number of CSU native students or college students who were working with me to kind of help design some of the curriculum, and then ended up working as mentors during the camp. So we did a lot of brainstorming about, okay, what, you know, what can we do on Zoom? What can't we do? And it actually, you know, it was definitely challenging, but we also, I mean, there were some really cool opportunities that came about, you know, because it was virtual and we didn't have to be in person. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And I definitely 100% want to talk about that. But before we get too far away from it, I'm a little bit curious about, you mentioned that you guys did learning sessions. So was that through the university or was that through the museum? I mean, whose learning sessions were those? Or listening sessions, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were sort of sponsored by the university, the school district, and the museum. We hosted them at the museum because I know, you know, when you're working with the Native community, I think it's important to think about, you know, accessible spaces, not just in terms of like, you know, ADA and where can people park and how far are they going to have to walk to get to the meeting room, which is of course mm-hmm. a concern on a university campus, but also just, you know, we really wanted it to be a space that felt neutral and where folks were really, you know, comfortable to kind of speak their mind. So, we had it at the museum, but the museum staff were sort of there at the beginning and said, hi, you know, we're really glad you're here. Want this to be a good space for you. And then they all left. So it was like literally just Native folks in the room mm-hmm. or, you know, parents of Native kids and that sort of thing, which I think was really, we really tried to be thoughtful about how to set the space up so that folks felt comfortable really diving into the issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And can you talk a little bit more about how you shaped those listening sessions? I mean, you talked about thinking about the space in addition to the space, like how do you get those kinds of conversations going and, you know, in a meaningful way?
Well, so we provided dinner. You know, that was, I think, you know, of course, if you give people food, it's easier to get them talking. So we tried to, you know, kind of think about structurally, like, you know, we were able to give everybody dinner. We had the CSU students there to do childcare. So it was kind of like a nice family space at the beginning. Everybody had dinner together and then the kids got to go off and explore the museum mm-hmm. and give the parents a chance to talk. And, you know, some of the older kids stayed for that conversation, which was kind of cool. I've never had an issue, especially if it's a multi-generational Native space. I've never had that much trouble getting folks talking. So it was more, you know, thinking about like, okay, how are we going to guide this and give some structure to it? So we, right. you know, we did like, I think broke folks up into smaller groups and kind of had, you know, just did some brainstorming and then tried to kind of narrow down from there. Like, okay, here's, you know, everything that anybody has ever had a problem with, you know, in terms of the educational system for Native people, you know, and then like, okay, let's narrow it down to like, you know, what are kind of the main things that we're seeing in the school district here and what do we want to do about it? What are kind of our ideas for, you know, what could we do in the next year, you know, 10 years from now? Okay, yeah, we want to have a fully funded Indian Ed program in the Poudre School District. That would be great. You know, so what can we do kind of working towards that vision?
Mm-hmm. So how did this become like the first piece of the puzzle, I guess, this camp? Was that kind of like everyone was like, yeah, we should do something?
Well, it kind of came from a lot of different directions at once. Mm-hmm. So part of it was that the museum you know, was really invested in this conversation. And so they were like, you know, tell us what we can do. And I had the background of putting stuff like this on before from my experience at U of I. That was like a key part of my job, was running the summer camp. And I had seen, you know, what that can do in terms of, you know, just building friendships among the students and getting them kind of thinking that like, okay, yeah, like STEM fields are not so intimidating. This is a thing I can see myself doing. So I think just kind of that convergence of like, we had the will and we had the know-how, and then, you know, we had the listening session in the community saying, okay, like, you know, some of our main problems here is that the students are socially isolated. They're the only native student in their classroom, and that's not great. There's not a sort of structured, you know, kind of way for them to engage in traditional science and indigenous knowledge, you know, that like, of course that happens in families, but, you know, that I think in a lot of ways, you know, indigenous knowledge and indigenous science practices, those are a community-based thing. It's not something you could always just do, you know, independently on your own. And so, you know, hearing from the community that, you know, they wanted, you know, something that would address some of these questions, and we had the resources to do it, it was kind of just like, okay, this is the, you know, the lines are converging into something like this. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things that I thought was really cool was, so the title of the program is Indigenous Science, Technology, Arts, and Resilience. And I really like that, because, I mean, obviously there's this huge focus on STEM right now, and then it kind of went to STEAM to include that arts aspect. But you guys, a main mm-hmm. focus, and it sounds like it makes sense coming from this isolation aspect, you had a main focus on resilience, which is, I think, mm-hmm. huge, but obviously not necessarily always recognized in these like STEM quote unquote frameworks.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and one of the things that I think was really important about the process is that it was not, you know, me coming in and saying like, okay, here, I can do this camp and it'll be like this. You know, what do y'all think? We mm-hmm. really tried at every step of the way to make sure that this was grounded in, you know, that we were doing the relational work, that it was grounded in what the community actually wanted. I had so many conversations with parents about, you know, what particular interests their kids had and, you know, and what they would want to see out of something like this. So, you know, even we started out thinking it was going to be a STEM camp, and then a number of parents were like, yeah, my the arts are really important to my kid. You know, if that's not part of it, they're not mm-hmm. going to be very invested. Like, okay,
right.
STEAM it is then, you know, which of course makes sense, you know, when you think about like, you know, so many indigenous arts practices are, you know, like you have to be good at STEM, you know, if you like, you have to like know math to do beadwork, right?
Right, right.
So there's just, you know, a lot of ways in which like that was a pretty natural fit. But then the resilience piece, I think was some of that was really, you know, part of this is that there's obviously some structural pieces here that we can't change right away for these kids, right? Like we can't make it so that they're not the only natives in their classroom. You know, we can't just like magically, you know, fix all of the teacher education programs so that every teacher they encounter will be culturally competent and like, you know, understand how to teach about Thanksgiving and things like that. But what we can do is make sure that the kids have the skills, that they are equipped with the emotional resilience to make it through those situations with their identity and their sense of well-being intact. So that was kind of, you know, and I think that piece is really connected to kind of the broader sense of Indigenous resilience, right? That like, if mm-hmm. our youth don't feel safe and empowered and valued and, you know, strong in their identity as an Indigenous person, we won't have, you know, thriving Indigenous communities in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, for me, I really see like part of the, a big piece of, you know, kind of Indigenous resilience writ large in terms of like, you know, making sure that our languages, our knowledges, our landscapes are all thriving. You know, that means youth that are able to do that stuff. And I think one piece of this, what's sort of unique about this camp is that there are actually, you know, quite a few programs out there that focus on the, you know, similar themes for Native youth. Most of them tend to be either on or near reservations because they're, you know, they're supported by the tribal government, or they're taking place in, you know, densely populated urban spaces, right? Like Denver, Minneapolis, you know, places where you have a pretty high concentration of Native folks in an urban space. there's not a lot out there for suburban Native kids, or, you know, Native kids who live in those like small towns where they're, you know, there might be a decent Native community in terms of size, but, you know, there's not the same kind of population density. And, you know, to me, that's really scary because like, that's a huge chunk of our youth that we're just missing, right? If we don't address that. So I think it's really important that we think about, you know, like ways to not recruit exactly, but, you know, think like youth who might otherwise grow up thinking like, okay, yeah, I'm Native, but that's not like a huge part of who I am. It's, you know, it's not a big deal. I want them to grow up thinking it's a big deal, you know, and that matters, and that they feel like that's a key piece of who they are and like how they're going to go out and be in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I have all the questions. So I guess, I mean, now I'm like daydreaming about having these camps everywhere, and that's, that's a bigger challenge than
me
today.
Too. That's what I want to see.
Yes. But getting back to this particular camp and the, you know, like all of these things that you're hoping to touch on with it. What did that actually look like during that week? Mm-hmm. Like what kind of activities were you doing with the kids? I mean, what ages were they? You know, all of that good stuff.
Sure. Yeah. We went K through 12. So all ages. There were a lot of folks who were like, no, I don't know if that's really going to work. I was like, nope. Intergenerational education. It's, you know, this is Indigenous ed. This is what it looks like. And it actually, that part worked out pretty well. So we had a pretty good spread in terms of ages that participated. So we recruited our kind of elder experts from the community. And that was one of the things that, you know, kind of worked out neat about having it be virtual, is that we were able to sort of cast a wider net when we had some folks who had to, you know, drop out at the last minute for other obligations. You know, I was able to contact some folks in, you know, just totally other areas. Even Shannon at the museum, who I was working with, had a friend from one of the pueblos in New Mexico. And, you know, I had taken another class with some folks in Minnesota who, you know, I knew were like good with kids and would be really good at this kind of stuff. So we had an expert come in each day who kind of shared something, some aspect of Indigenous knowledge. And we totally did not plan this, but it worked out that all of our experts were moms, which I thought was kind of cool. You know, like those are the folks in our communities right now who are like on the cutting edge of doing science and combining it with culture and Indigenous knowledge. So they would come in the morning. We would all get on Zoom together. They would, you know, talk with the kids, you know, sort of like a presentation of sorts. And then we would do some kind of small group work to kind of calibrate whatever the activity was for the age of the students. So, you know, sometimes we had activities where like the 6-year-olds were doing something slightly different than what the high schoolers were doing. And then the kids had a couple hours to go off on their own and do whatever the activity was. So on the first day of camp, their activity was to interview someone in their family about their background and what Indigenous knowledge is and what sorts of Indigenous knowledge is their family engages in. And then they had a couple other activities that were kind of more arts based, you know, designing, making floral designs, you know, different things like that. But it was really cool because it was something where all of the participants were able to bring in their particular tribal knowledge and background to what they were doing. So it wasn't just like, okay, we're all Natives, so we're going to do beadwork. It was like, you know, what plants are important to your family? What, you know, what particular medicines are important to your tribe? Okay, so let's talk about that, you know, and then your project is going to reflect that instead of just kind of generic Indigenous stuff.
All right. Well, we are already at our second break point, which is always sneaks up so fast. But I'd love to talk more about this after the break and also break down some more of how you guys were able to adapt with the pandemic and provide, you know, maybe some guidance that other people who are trying to do educational stuff online might find helpful. So we will be back right here in a moment.
Hello, it's Jim Eagle. Please join us for the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Society's 11th Annual Two-Spirit Powwow in person or online this year at San Francisco Fort Mason Center on Saturday, February 12th, 2022. Gore dance at noon and grand entry begins at 1 p.m. There will be over 60 vendors selling all types of Indigenous products and crafts. Powwow dancers from all over the U.S. will be competing in contests all day long. We'll also be having several delicious fry bread taco vendors. For more information, go to baits.org. That's BAAITS.org. COVID protocols will be in effect. See you there.
All right. We're back for our final segment. So I'm really excited to talk more about your camp and how you adapted to COVID. Although, as I mentioned when we were off air, it's nice that in some ways you didn't really have to adapt to COVID because it was your first camp. So you could get really creative without feeling like you had this camp that you wanted to like recreate online. You could like totally think about it in a really different way. But so let's imagine we're March a year ago. What was the reaction to the pandemic and how you were going to adapt the program from what maybe you had already started planning?
Yeah. Well, it's been a year. I think our biggest concern was just what needs were changing in the community. And like if there were, you know, additional concerns that families had, you know, obviously like, you know, our camp was not, we were not the only ones trying to figure out this like hasty transition to a virtual situation. So I was also, you know, putting my classes online and all of the students for the camp, you know, they were all of a sudden are in virtual school that, you know, no one is trained or prepared for. So our kind of our first thing was just like an emergency, like, okay, what are the new, like, what's happening now? You know, what needs do we have now? And are there ways that we can address that too? So I was doing like Zoom conferences with small groups of the parents to talk about like how is online school going? And, you know, what are there any sort of new issues emerging because of that? What's working, what's not? So one of the things, you know, that sort of came out of that is that parents, especially of the high schoolers, you know, looking at college in the future, maybe, and needing to graduate. So kind of getting behind academically, especially in subjects like math, became very quickly a real concern. So luckily we were able to kind of recruit and find CSU students who could work as tutors. So for I think it was almost a month leading up to the camp, we had daily tutoring sessions that were just, you know, drop in that we were able to offer for any of the high school students who wanted just like a little extra help or support. So there's a lot of kind of that, like almost sort of like triage of immediate needs. And then also, you know, it was kind of lucky, I think, in the way that you're talking about that, you know, that wasn't like there was the standard or expectation that anybody had of what the camp was going to be like. But it was a little hard for me to kind of deviate from, like, I still had a vision in my head, like, this is what it's going to look like. This is what we can do. So it was really tough to kind of like, you know, make that jump, like, okay, it's just going to be what it is. And, you know, and so it was a little hard for me to not feel like, oh, this isn't going to be quite as good, or this won't be impactful the same way. So I had to do a lot of like, okay, save that idea. Someday we will be able to be in person again. And then, you know, maybe we can use that in the future. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we did really have to just, you know, kind of throw everything away that we had started with, you know, like, okay, you know, we're going to tan a hide and then talk about how like that, you know, that's science, you know, to be able to do these steps. And like, well, we're not going to be able to do that. So like, let's start from scratch. So there's definitely some, you know, stress that went with that sort of reinventing, but it did, you know, as I said, it opened up a lot of opportunities to connect with folks from outside the area and to think about, you know, okay, you know, even back then, a year ago, we were already seeing that isolation is a huge impact of all of this, right? That like, you know, whether it's kids having to do virtual school or just like families feeling disconnected, you know, even sort of that early on into things, we knew that that was going to be an issue. So that, you know, knowing that that was a major concern, I think in some ways actually made it a little easier, because then a lot of the planning we were doing was just like, okay, how can we make sure that folks stay connected, whether it's the kids with each other or making sure that the families are connected, you know, so that they're able to, you know, kind of work across those sort of artificial barriers of being at different schools and, or, you know, different grade levels and things like that.
So how was it technology wise? I mean, was there any issues with accessibility in terms of computers and internet and things like that? And if so, were you guys able to work around those issues?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we were really thinking that was going to be a huge challenge, and we're fully prepared, you know, figuring out like, okay, where are we going to get extra laptops? You know, can we work with the internet providers? Like, you know, to get kind of some hotspots that would be available to folks. And luckily, the other faculty that I was working with had was doing similar work for different communities in Fort Collins. So we knew that there were ways to do it. We were prepared to set that up. But actually, you know, because most of the kids were in some kind of virtual school, a lot of the families were, you know, they were sort of already ready to do this that way because they, you know, they had already had to figure out like, okay, we've got three kids who all need to be in, you know, online class at the same time. We've got to figure out this device situation. So one thing I'll say the school district did that I think was really great was they made sure that like every family in the school district who needed it had access to, I think they were like Chromebooks or something like that. So all of the kids in the district had access to the devices that they needed. And because the camp was so close to when the school started, you know, they had to turn them back in for the summer, but then they checked them back out for the start of the school year. So we were really prepared for that to be a problem. It didn't end up being as much of an issue as we had anticipated. We did, you know, there were, of course, like bandwidth issues with everybody being in the same house. You know, we had several families where they, you know, had multiple kids who were participating in the camp. And we had originally thought, okay, we can do, you know, breakout groups with the different ages concurrently, and did have to change that since we knew, you know, for some of the families, like that just there wasn't enough bandwidth to run multiple devices on Zoom at the same time. So it worked out that we would have siblings kind of just share a device to log into the main Zoom with the whole group at the beginning. And then we had a schedule where everybody did their age-based breakout groups at a different time, which ended up working out a little better.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, I've got all the questions. So I guess first, how did that go with the age group? So you had like a big age group, and you'd mentioned before that you thought it was really successful. So can you talk about, you know, the big group with all the ages and then the split out and how you shaped kind of what went where, I guess?
Yeah. So, you know, it was one of the things that was pretty important to me starting out that, you know, I wanted it to be all ages, just, you know, sort of based on principles of Indigenous education. And it's something I just had seen, you know, being in community spaces with Native folks, that's how learning happens. Is, you know, you have youth and elders in the same place, you know, and when we're learning, you know, whether it's ceremony or powwows or just, you know, whatever kind of community space, I think a lot, you know, you see that happening organically and it's not split out into, you know, formal age groups. So it was something I really wanted to at least try going into it. And I have to give a lot of props to the CSU student mentors who worked for the camp. They did just a phenomenal job of, you know, none of them were like early childhood education majors or anything like that, but they really just like dove into the deep end with, you know, figuring out like, okay, how can we make sure everybody stays engaged? What do we need to do to, you know, make sure that the conversation is something that the high schoolers can contribute to on their level and the younger kids are still interested in. So a lot of the credit there goes to those students. They did a really awesome job. But it worked out pretty well. And I think one of the things that helped was that we were pretty like family focused rather than individual student focused. So there was a lot of ways for like siblings, you know, to kind of contribute to each other's projects or kind of help each other out. So we really tried to like, you know, where there were those pre-existing structures of family and siblings and to kind of take advantage of that with the way we designed the activities and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you're working with, you know, high school kids, I mean, obviously you had the college student mentors and I imagine they were paid, I would guess.
Yes.
And then the high school students, I mean, were you kind of framing it for them as, you know, like that they were leaders or, you know what I mean? How did you give them sort of like an incentive to feel really engaged and like it wasn't just a thing for kids, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we tried with the activities to kind of, you know, when we did like our age-based breakouts where we sort of modified the activities, we tried to kind of engage the high schoolers on a different level. So like, you know, okay, yeah, the little kids might be doing this. Like, I think you all can, you know, kind of level up and do it this way and maybe like look for a way to challenge yourself with it, you know, and the kids that we had who were, who were participating were really, I mean, they were pretty excited about it, which was neat to see, because I, you know, having worked with high schoolers before, I was ready to have to kind of pull teeth to get mm-hmm. them to want to engage over Zoom. But they were really great. But that was one thing we kind of learned and are thinking about for this next year's program, is how can we engage the high schoolers as leaders, exactly like you're saying. So we're thinking about trying to see if there's a way we can do, like, maybe have the high schoolers kind of act as like junior mentors, and then maybe do some credit recovery as part of that. So like they're able to get, you know, high school credit for doing work for the camp, and maybe even involve them in some of the curriculum design and planning and those sorts of things. Like, just, you know, so that we know what it is they want to be learning about, or what it is they'd like to do, or what kinds of art, you know, they want to work on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So thinking about next year, or well, this year, it's camp. <Yeah. laughs> first of all, okay, because, you know, a lot of things are up in the air and might preemptively go to Zoom, even if in theory, you know, by that time, maybe they could do it in person. So what advice, first mm-hmm. of all, would you give to people trying to do something like this in the world that we are in at the moment, and hopefully won't be in for too much longer?
Yeah. Yeah.
What advice would you give?
Well, you know, honestly, in some of the ways, I think the advice for trying to do this, you know, maybe virtually or maybe hybrid, is sort of the same advice I would give about working within Native communities more generally. Like, I think there was definitely some things are really consistent, which is that you have to be flexible and prepared for things to come up, you know, that you haven't anticipated. And so that's, you know, as we're planning it now, I'm kind of like trying to hold in mind like three totally different, like, okay, if we're virtual, it's like this, if we're hybrid, it's like that, if we're in person, maybe we can do these things, you know. And I know oftentimes for non-Native folks or organizations who are planning stuff like this, like, people really like to have things kind of nailed down ahead of time. And I think there's just a level of like being willing to fly by the seat of your pants a little bit that, you know, whether you're in a pandemic or not, can be really helpful when you're doing this kind of community work. And I also think the other kind of big thing is to make sure that you're doing the relationship work, because, you know, whatever happens, like whatever stuff comes up or things change or need to be adapted, if the relationships are in place and that piece is really strong, the rest of the stuff will work out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with both of those 100%. Okay. So what are you looking at for this year? I mean, you said you had three options in your head, basically. What are you thinking this year's camp might look like?
Yeah. Well, I'm really hoping, best case scenario, the vaccine will be available and we will be able to do some stuff in person. I would like to actually, you know, have us be able to brain tan a hide together. That's like, I want to check that box that we got to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, hopefully we will be able to do that. I've also been trying to think about some ideas for like, okay, if we have maybe some families who are comfortable being in person or have been vaccinated, other families who aren't, you know, how can we maybe have kind of a hybrid where, like, you know, those who can be there are doing something in sort of a classroom setting in the morning, and then some of our other participants are doing the same activity, but on Zoom. And then maybe the afternoons we're able to get together in someplace outside where we can stay like physically distanced in family bubbles, you know, and still like see each other's faces and kind of be hands-on, but, you know, in a way that's pretty safe. Or, you know, or even just like, what are the things we can do outside of the camp, right? Because this stuff is never like a one and done, like, okay, it's just this week and then we're good, right? So I've been trying to think of like, okay, can we do like maybe a weekend activity, like, you know, sort of the month before or the month after, where families are able to come and participate in something where they're really only going to be able to interact, where they're only going to be interacting with the folks that came with them, but we're all doing the same thing. So then when the kids get together, you know, later on Zoom, like, we all have the same experience and we can talk about it, even if we didn't physically do it exactly at the same time in the same place.
Yeah. So, okay. As far as this year, I mean, are you imagining that you're going to have basically the same kids, or, well, I guess basically, what does your recruiting strategy look like?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm hoping we will have the majority of our participants back for a second year. I am optimistically shooting to hopefully double our participation rate. We've done some recruiting just, informally by talking to, friends of the families that were already participating. And then also there's a Ro Bubar, who's another faculty member in my department, does a community dinner every year, which she also had to adapt to be virtual this year. So instead of a dinner for the whole Native community to get together in one place, we did kind of a drive-through, pick up and go situation, focusing on families that were dealing with food insecurity. Mm-hmm. So we actually collaborated with her and her partner when they ran that program to hand out activity kits for any of the families with kids that, had some information about the camp and stuff like that. So we're just like trying to take advantage of, every like whatever's out there, because of course we can hope to recruit through the school based on the information they have about who the Native students are. But, data about Native people is always a little iffy. We get labeled as something else by CNN. Right. So there, we're trying not to lean on that too hard and think of other creative ways we could make sure that we're reaching out to other folks in the community who might want to participate.
Oh man. I guess that's a question that I have too, is have you guys thought about, or was this an aspect of your camp last year, incorporating any sort of, did you mail the kids anything ahead of time? So for example, I'm thinking about obviously how important it is, to eat together and with adults have coffee together. And mm-hmm. And I've seen some really creative ways of people doing that over the past year. But I remember obviously last summer there was the, oh God, is it contaminated if we touch it? So maybe
totally.
You guys weren't thinking about that then, but is that something that you guys have thought about?
Yeah. So what we ended up doing is we dropped off a box, like a Rubbermaid tub, kind of tote thing for each of our participants at the beginning of the week that had all of the supplies and everything in it. So at that point, I think we knew that if you let it sit for 24 hours or whatever, that it was pretty safe. So we dropped all the supplies off before the camp started so that they had those, and tried to include some just if you're bored and, want a coloring sheet or whatever, some stuff like that too, as well as the specific supplies and then snacks for each day of the week. And then we actually, the museum staff all just pitched in to deliver lunch every day. So all of the participants had lunch from one of the local restaurants that was doing takeout that got delivered each morning. And then everybody also, luckily through the Bohemian Foundation, just local here in Fort Collins, they have we're running this Feeding Our Community program for folks dealing with food insecurity. So any of our families who noted that was an issue for them, we were able to deliver dinner for their entire household as well.
Nice.
And then it was a really good way to also get folks connected with other forms of support and resources in the community, which I think is really important. Sometimes people just don't know what's out there, mm-hmm. what's available when they're in need of stuff like that.
Right. Well, and that's really nice too, because it also supports a local business and it's a way of doing it without making people feel, because that would be totally normal if you went to a camp that there would be food, you know what I mean? So you're addressing something that they've said is a need, but without making it weird,
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man. Well, we are already at the end. Is there anything else that you feel like thinking about the camp last year, this year, anything that comes to mind that you think would be helpful for people wanting to do something similar in their communities or in communities that they work with, et cetera?
Yeah. I think maybe one of the most important things to think about is that, like I said, these programs are never just one and done. The week is over. You're no longer, responsible to the community. So I think that's a really big piece of it, is thinking about how are we building these kinds of programs in ways that are sustainable. And, as I mentioned, the CSU students were a huge part of what really made this work. And they did such a phenomenal job. And so that's the piece I think I'm really excited to work on expanding, is their role in putting this all together and putting it on. I would love to get to a point where I just sort of work myself out of a job here, because I get to hand it over to, the youth themselves, right? To actually put this together and put it on. And I just think that thinking about ways that we're, doing this in a way that's sort of self-sustaining because we're developing the capacity of the community to address its own needs, I think is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're going to have to end it. I do know, though, that you have a book coming out somewhat soon. What's the title of that for anyone that's interested in learning more about your work, especially related to salmon, which we didn't really get to at all?
Well, the book might be a minute before it's out.
Okay.
But it's right now the working title is Dammed by the State, Indian Fishing and the Geographies of Settler Colonialism in the Columbia River Basin.
I like it. Dammed by the State. That's a clever play on word there. All right. Well, thank you so much again for coming on the show. I certainly learned a lot and I'm thinking a lot about how I would do, well, how I'm going to be working on a similar camp this summer and, you know, getting all these great ideas from you. And I'm sure that our listeners learned a lot as well. So thank you again.
Thanks for having me. I love talking about this stuff. So this was really fun.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.